Good evening. Did you want to introduce at all, Ben? Or I don't mind. I'm very happy to introduce myself. Actually, Ben's more important, I feel, so it's important to have a...
I'm being less important.
Hello. Well, just a couple of bits of housekeeping before we start and reintroduce Rob. The first one is the ubiquitous AES register. If you don't mind filling this in, or even if you do, would you please, just so we can keep track of numbers and know for fire and safety and all that kind of stuff, how many people are here. That's right. Yes, we just subtract the number of people we rescue from the number of people on this list and we know. And the other thing is, well, before we start, really, just to thank Dolby for really upping the ante in terms of hospitality and looking after us this evening.
Agreed.
So thank you very much, Dolby, both for your generosity and for being one of the few audio companies that's still very solvent. Thank you. And I'll now hand you over to Rob Tolson, who I think is the Director of Research at Anglia Ruskin University.
Director of a bit of research, yeah.
Director of a bit of research. Director of two times research over three. I'll hand you over to him.
Thanks. Obviously, it's a great pleasure to be here at Dolby to be able to present the research that we're doing at Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge. So thanks for coming. I did really want to start and ask, to be honest, who's here to watch the film? Okay, there's a few hands going up there. You're presenting a poster. And doubly excellent, excellent to be able to sit and watch a film afterwards in this cinema, and I'm really looking forward to that myself. So, for the record, there was only three hands went up actually. So I'm taking that as a result thus far. I may ask at the end and see if people have changed their minds. But okay, so let's move on. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about how we structure our research and activities at Anglia Ruskin in Cambridge. Really, we're a university. We're lots of people coming at audio from different angles. We've obviously got a music department, and we've got a computing and technology department, and both of those departments have got research teams, research groups, and there's the SERG, Surge Sound Engineering Research Group, in the Department of Computing and Technology, and we've got the Digital Performance Lab, which Tom and Richard actually are here today, and they're presenting some posters, and I think already a few people have been quite interested in what they're doing. My role is not too different, but in a way, I'm involved in what we call our research institute, which is sort of more, although it is attached to the arts faculty, it's more designed to be cross-disciplinary and to be looking across faculties. So we really try to engage in anything that is arts and creativity and culture meets technology. So I'm an audio engineer, a sound engineer, and so that's where I come into that. But we also look at gaming and the different different disciplines that go into game design and gaming, film, anything to do with digital economy in terms of things like law, social networking, all these sort of things that bring arts and technology together. So we collaborate on certain things, and we do things autonomously as well, depending on what the research projects are. And all I want to do now is really just talk for 20, 30 minutes about, just give an overview of projects. So I'm going to just fly through probably a number of different projects really fast and just sort of highlight a few of the things. And some of them are those that are on the posters in the foyer. So I think also after this, we're going to take a 15-minute, 20-minute break, time to get another drink. Feel free to come and talk to us about the posters and a bit about what we've discussed here as well, so before the film. So I was going to start off with this one. I'll just fly through this, really. But this is probably our biggest value project in terms of funding. So it's a European-funded FP7 project to develop new types of sound absorbers. And it's a consortium project with a number of companies and research institutes across Europe, most notably DAMP and RPG, who make and develop acoustic sound absorbers. And the reason this project's, I suppose, innovative is that it's for use in buildings that are made out of concrete, so thermal mass buildings that use concrete walls, concrete ceilings to take energy in, heat energy, and to give it back in cold times. And the only problem with those type of buildings is they're exceptionally reverberant, but you can't use fibrous and standard sound absorbers because they're insulators, they're heat insulators. So this company, Deamp, have been for a number of years selling these acrylic sound absorbers, which are basically just slotted sheets of acrylic. And they use a Helmholtz effect to take energy out of the acoustic environment. And what problem is, it's too expensive. So what we're trying to do is to work out how cheap we can make it before it stops working, basically. So we've done our modelling and some lab testing, and we're now onto room testing and things like that. So a good project, very much an engineering project. This is another of our kind of, one of the things we've got at Anglia Ruskin is a very sort of affluent music therapy department. We've got a number of professors in music therapy, and they teach very much the conventional and classical methods of music therapy. But we've been engaged to basically try and develop, or at least investigate, how technology can change music therapy. What options does it bring? Not really talking about replacing conventional instruments with new instruments, but looking at whether technology can help, for instance, to enhance the amount of therapy that can take place. So, for instance, in this project, we're looking at autism. Someone with autism may see a therapist once a week, but if we can develop some technology, they can actually probably have therapeutic sessions with their parents during the week, or maybe some remote therapy sessions where you actually don't have to be in the same room and so on. So we're looking at this kind of technology. Myself and Richard actually have developed this very simple system, actually, which is just two. It's an interface with two sensors and a bit of electronics, and Richard's coded that into making sounds based on the order of interaction. Now, with two, effectively, these hand shapes are two switches, but actually, you can create quite a complex state diagram of the order of interaction. So you can have two hands being on the switches at the same time, you can have one and then the other, and the orders, so two and then one off, is different to none and then one on, and so on. So, and when you include timing into that, we can create a number of different scenarios. So I'm going to play some of these little videos. Of these aren't tested on subjects. These are people at Cambridge University who are collaborating with, actually.
So when we do it at the same time.
So pretty simple stuff, but in terms of working with autistic children, actually getting them to work together and in synchronization and actually developing that kind of connection with their therapist is a really important thing. And I don't know, those guys, at least they discovered something. This one, I'll just show you this, because something here happens which can only be described as a moment. To be honest, I don't really know what happened, but something happened and it generated something more, a new experience. They connected in some way, you know. So so that's what we were testing it for. And we're now using this. This was a pilot study, which we're now taking forward to apply for larger scale funds to actually take into full scale health research. These are just extracts from Richard and Tom's papers, posters, which are outside, but I just wanted to highlight them because I find them really fascinating. Tom's in particular, well, initially Tom's, because it's looking at this this very early method of multi-track composition. So this is a piece of tape which has got a number of edits on it, as you can see. And this is developed by Morton Feldman and put together by John Cage back in the 50s. And Tom's had access to these master tapes. There's eight of them. They play at the same time, so they play in multi-track, and it's probably one of the earliest sort of use of multi-track, but a very novel way of composition. And this is one of Richard's examples, where actually these are materials and interfaces, and these guys will explain it to you a lot better than I do, but actually are these are conductive materials which will detect pressure and proximity, and these, so there's a dance performance going on, and as they interact with the materials, that generates some form of signals which creates live score. So then there's musicians playing the live score that's being generated by the dance and interaction. So quite fascinating use of technology in a really creative and compositional way. This is fairly similar. This is a project I worked on, which was to develop a painting that uses conductive ink. I've been working with Arm for a little while, and this guy Eduardo Katz wanted to develop a painting that you could touch, and as you touch it, it would what he asked for was for it to sing. And so the black areas of ink on the painting are actually conductive, so they work in a similar way to a theremin, really. They detect the human proximity, and there's some electronics inside, which, and some loudspeakers in the frame, which creates some sound. So I'll just play you a bit of this, just so you can imagine the vision. I mean, all it's doing is triggering sound samples. Each point is a sensor, and it's triggering sound samples. But in a creative way, that was what we were looking for. Where Eduardo's now looking for opportunities to make some much larger ones that more than one person can interact with at any one time. So I don't know, hopefully there's a real you can see this kind of coming together of creative and artistic uses of technology, as well as just sort of audio and engineering, in its rawest sense. Very quickly, this is a project that I'm working on with a couple of companies in London, and it's basically it's Nesta funded, so it's to look at how music formats have changed over the years, and given Bjork's album app, which she released her album as. She released her album as an app a year and a half ago, and that was 12 months before it came out on CD. Looking at whether that's a really legitimate format for selling music in the future. Now, it's not really aimed at mobile devices. It's more aimed at the future for smart TVs and that sort of thing, where maybe your music library will live on your smart TV, and it will also have rich content in it. So it will have animations and footage and artwork and song lyrics and all these things. And the reason for this project really is because, you know, the argument is that some things have been lost from the days of vinyl, when artwork and song lyrics and producer credits and studio credits were really things people were interested in. And this stage we're at with MP3s, that's kind of disappeared a bit. And we're just evaluating whether this is a likely format that may bring some of that back. Here's the drum tuning application. I don't know if any of you heard of this. This is Phil's research. Actually, Phil, who's now at Cambridge University, did his PhD with us on this. And it's essentially a guitar tuner for drums. It's based on some quite high level scientific research. Again, Phil's got a poster out there, on ratios and frequencies and, modal patterns across a drum head. And with that knowledge, we've developed this iPhone app, which really is not much more than a guitar tuner, but with some sensible signal processing specific for drums, but based on that core research. What else we got? Okay, loudness analysis. Again, we're doing quite a lot on loudness analysis. We've been interested in loudness since a long time ago, actually, since, well, yeah, a number of years, myself and Justin, actually, who's here from London College of Music at the University of West London, is collaborating with us on. And over the years, we've been looking, everybody's been interested in the loudness war for the last 5 or 6 years. And we started to look at it in a more kind of broader sense. Particularly this last piece of research was looking at distortion. So not really forgetting about the whole compression of the waveform thing, but actually looking at the quality of the audio pre and post processing. So, I have this idea that actually a lot of the problem with overcompressed music isn't necessarily the loss of dynamic range. It's more the increase of distortion that's created through the compression processes that are going on there. So we've been evaluating the difference between compressing the signals, be these instruments or raw signals, prior to summation, and compressing those after summation. I've got a little demo which I wanted to show. Where is it? Which hopefully shows a little bit of this, because obviously if you actually compress or put a signal through a nonlinear process, that signal's got a sort of more than one frequency, we get what's called intermodulation distortion. So I'm just going to demonstrate that really with a few sine waves. So here's a sine wave, 200 hertz, and all I'm going to do here is turn on a compressor on that sine wave. It's a limiter, so it's a fast acting high ratio compressor. Let's just switch that off. That's what happens. So when we compress, we generate some distortion components. And I've got a second one here which is now 300 hertz, and I can compress that as well and create some distortion components. But let's do those both together. So there we go, we got the two fundamental frequencies and the distortion components, which are, in this instance, because it's a sine wave, which are harmonically related to the fundamentals. If I now take those compressors off and put them on the output, i.e. after summation, we get this. Bit of a difference. So, so now we see not just harmonic components, but components that are at inharmonic frequencies, and i.e. intermodulation. So really looking at this in almost from an education perspective, to say, when you're mixing or processing audio, the order of doing things really can make a massive difference. Hopefully that came across, I'm sure. The other thing Bill's been doing, our colleague Bill, who's not here, is looking at masking from this same over compression. And there's a really good example here. He's just been looking at some spectrograms of some audio that's prior to compression and after compression. And I'm just looking at this example here, B1. And what we see is, actually, I think this is a kick drum and this is a bass guitar note. And after compression, the bass guitar note has become intensified and the kick drum has virtually disappeared. So the compression hasn't increased the volume of all instruments to the same effect. In effect, it's the fact that that bass guitar sound is there at the same time as the kick drum, when applied to compression, causes a form of masking, which might be manageable. But another of my colleagues has really gone to town on John Ward has gone to town on looking at remasters of very old audio and looking at the way that they've been remastered, compressed, to the extent where the swing has been lost in a hi-hat section and really changed the feel of the audio purely because of that sort of use of compression. So again, not trying to dwell too much on the whole fatigue and loudness and dynamic range, which clearly is open to discussion as well, but looking at these other effects of the loudness war as well. Let's see what's next. Yeah, Ali's he's a lecturer and doing his PhD as well in forensics, and this is electric network frequency analysis, which I'll just, again, he's got a post about there. Just as an overview, this is effectively the 50 hertz signal. I think we can hear a bit of it just now. The 50 hertz signal that that comes out of the mains, basically, and unless you've got exceptionally good filtering in the electronics that you're using, some of that will creep through. The thing is, throughout the course of the day, it doesn't stay at 50 hertz. It moves through the course of the day between about 49 and about 51 hertz. And if you can extract that 50 hertz profile from an audio recording, and you've got the data from the National Grid that tells you what the profile of the change of frequency was throughout the day, you can verify whether a recording was actually recorded at that time of day or not. You can also spot edits, because there'll be a step change in frequency rather than a jump. And I mean, this graph on the right, on your left, is basically the data we got from the electric grid. So this was published on their website. Every 15 seconds, what the frequency is from the National Grid versus that which we measured and extracted through our algorithm. So that's to prove our algorithm works, and we're now working on actually proving that, or validating actually. There are many reasons why this may not work as well, actually, in terms of real life battery powered devices and all these things. So we're kind of evaluating, really, is this how viable is this? But with forensics, there's a couple of other things with forensics, and one is watermarking. I saw some papers recently about watermarking, which is where you inject a signal that's probably an analog representation of a digital message or code or metadata, but you can inject that in a way that psychoacoustically we won't hear it, so you can extract it, so you can watermark a piece of audio. And I think that's even more interesting if we start to work at higher frequencies, because if we do start to record at, let's say, 96 kilohertz, then actually we have a bandwidth from 20 to 40 odd kilohertz where there is inaudible bandwidth that we could potentially encode analog represent metadata. So that's I think that's interesting. I saw some publications by the Fraunhofer Institute at AES New York just a couple of weeks ago. The other is fingerprinting, which we've done a little bit of work on, which is effectively the Shazam algorithm. So I'm sure you've all heard of the Shazam algorithm, which is where you can hold your phone up to the radio and it'll tell you what song's playing. And it's quite an incredible algorithm, because it does it very fast, and you know, it's incredibly capable. Its success is very high. The thing originally was, what's the use of this? And I think the biggest use people got out of it was in like pub quizzes when people were playing. And so it's like this amazing piece of technology that no one really knew what the use was. I've got an example, actually, because I did some work for a company, a few of us did some work for a company, looking at how easy or how possible it is to implement this algorithm, and it's all published. This is not really research. This is just implementing the Shazam algorithm that's been public domain for a while. So let me just load this up. This should work. So I've got a little data, but this is my little tool for recording some audio and comparing it against a database of audio files. So I just need to load this database. We built this for a company that was hiring the Shazam algorithm. So they were using this algorithm on something equivalent to the iPlayer. So imagine you're watching a nature program and there's some audio as some geese are flying over the water or something, and you love that piece of audio and you really want to know what it is. You can click on this app and it will tell you what that piece of music is, so you can go and buy it. But they were really worried that Shazam might one day say, we're not going to license you our algorithm anymore. So they wanted to know how possible it would be to create their own. So this was just a little test. Hopefully it will work. So that's just loading a database I haven't got loads of songs. Obviously, Shazam has millions of songs in its database. So that's loaded. I'm just going to play some audio and record it in. So I'm going to choose something that I know I'm allowed to play without any issues. so let's pick this. And I'm just going to... I hate it. So just playing some audio. It's Ethan Ash. Take some time. So I'm just going to record this in. Okay, so that's now recorded, 6 seconds of that audio. I'll just play it back. Hopefully this isn't too loud. I'll just play this back. This way, so that's what it's just recorded. I'm afraid. And all it's done is it's taken that audio file on the left, and it's just created a spectrogram of it. And the little red dots are basically the peaks. It's just found a load of peaks. In that audio, 6 second audio sample. What it does now is it then looks at those peaks and it takes adjacent peaks, and it starts working out DF and DT, so difference in frequency and difference in time between all the consecutive peaks, and then it puts those. It does what's called a hash. It hashes those into a 24-bit number, which really doesn't mean anything, but now we have a table from 0 to whatever 24 bits is, and every single one of those hashes it can plot the song's unique identifier in. Then when it goes to analyze it, then does the same thing, analyzes, goes to the table and sees how many of those match, and the one that's got the most matches is likely to be the one. So let's do a match to database. Here you go. So take some time. So it says here, take some time. So it's found this linearity of matches in all of those. And because this song matched 47 individual hashes, that's more than any other. So the good thing with this algorithm is that because it works on peaks, the noise floor can be incredibly high before it stops working. Because, you know, those peaks are there and the noise can just come up and up and up. So long as those peaks are still above the noise, it works, which is why it works in the pub quiz when there's a rowdy crowd behind you. So so that was quite a fun bit of work, really. I've just put that there. That was a bit of consultancy work, and like any research institute, we try to engage with industry and do consultancy work. And these are just a few things. We've done a bit of consultancy work for DTS recently. And this company, Audio Analytic, are Cambridge-based, actually an ex PhD graduate of ours, who's developed an analysis. It's kind of fingerprinting algorithm for detecting certain audio samples. And this one's interesting, aggressive language. He designed this to detect aggression in hospital waiting rooms. So there's a microphone in the corner of the room, and if someone starts swearing or shouting, it can detect that change of tonality and warn a security guard. We did some testing on this, which was quite funny because it meant we had to go out into the street and get people to swear and shout and scream into microphones so we could get a data set. And then I had to play them back at various volumes for a 2 or 3 days period from one of our research labs, which did freak a few people out. But it also, you know, I think they're now developing patches for gunshot and things. And he's doing exceptionally well, Chris Mitchell, and he collaborates with us as well. Last couple of slides, actually. So the other thing we do, obviously, is put on events. We've got this great digital gallery in Anglia. And although that's an art gallery, it's a place where we can put on rich media performances, and a number of Richard and Tom's events have been put on in there, where we can actually do audio, visual and live music at the same time. And this is Tom's event, the Electronic and Computer Music Symposium, which was just a few months ago, and Peter Zinoviev actually performed on his 80th birthday at that event. So that was pretty exciting. We did the audio design workshop with Prism recently at Anglia Ruskin, and this one, although it's gaming, we run this gaming festival once a year called Brains Eden, which is where we get a number of, actually this year it was 150 students from all over Europe come to our university for 2 days. And some of those are game designers, some of those are artists, some of those are audio specialists, so musicians and audio specialists for game. And they come in teams, actually, and on the first day they're given a task to build a game on the theme of something. And on the third day, on the Monday morning, when none of them have had any sleep, they're judged by these companies, Arm and PlayStation and Jagex, and who are all resident in Cambridge, actually. So it's quite nice having those on our doorstep. So again, it's another link of audio into that industry. I will mention the Innovation in Music conference, which myself and Justin and a few other people are quite heavily involved in. This is a new conference which is taking place in December for the first time in York this year. So we're looking to build that up as well as a place where not only can the music and the technology be come together, but also the business of the music industry. So innovative business models are just as valuable in this context. And that's it. The final thing is the kind of music production that we do. And I've got to plug this album, which is out next week, which I've engineered and mixed. And it's because it's a Christmas album. And if you're not ready for Christmas yet, this is the start of it. I've spent all year recording Christmas carols, and starting in March, and spent 14 hours on the hottest day of the year mixing Christmas carols this year. And you know, it's been a good project. Hopefully it'll do well. But a lot of us are all producing or performing or composing. You know, we're very active creatively as well. And we do work closely with the MPG and James, and there's and we give a workshop for the a workshop at the AES New York this year, and that's Mandy Parnell as well, who's sort of heavily involved in the AES and the MPG, and so there's a good bit of crossover there. So I mean, a lot of we're very interested in kind of audio for music as much as audio for the sake of audio in a lot of what we do. You know, I think music's kind of the passion that kind of gets us into the audio industry in the first place, and so I kind of try to keep it linked to the research we do. So that's it. I'm sorry I've flown through that quite fast, but we're going to go outside and hopefully there's chance to chat, and you can chat to my colleagues. There's time for questions now if there are any questions. It's a bit dark, isn't it? I'm conscious that I can't even see if anyone puts their hand up, really. Maybe there were lots of hands went up earlier. I only counted three. But if there's any questions out, or we can go outside, we can just grab a quick drink and have a chat and come back in for the film. So there you go. Thank you. Feel free to email me if there's any of these projects. I can put you in touch with any of the people that have done research that we've mentioned. So